Hi everyone, it's Bud, and welcome to the latest episode of Before the Cheering Started, all about the journey to success and professional fulfillment. I was taught long ago by a great copy editor, never use the word unique, because it means that there really is only one of its kind. Let's say this, when you hear Bill Raftery analyzing a basketball game on television, there is no confusing him with anyone else. I spoke to him in the months leading up to the NCAA basketball tournament on a busy day at the Raftery home. He brings a level of fun and excitement to the game, not just at this time of year, but to any game, and it's backed up with a tremendous amount of preparation. Long before he was known nationally for his catchphrases like onions and man a man. By the way, that is the worst Bill Raftery impersonation ever. Raftery coached at Seton Hall. He worked for a bank. He was a local recreation director. And he was a hell of a ball player in college at LaSalle in Philly and at St. Cecilia High School in Kearny, New Jersey, where he became the all-time leading scorer in New Jersey state history. Let's just say that if I ever was the all-time leading scorer in, forget about state history, like in my county, in my school, in my neighborhood, in my house, there wouldn't be a day goes by that I didn't mention it. So it's been a while now, you're doing broadcasting, but it's never come up like, you know, I actually could play as well.
Nobody really cares though. If you do something you really enjoy, that's enough satisfaction. So you sort of, you know, time passes, better players come along, and obviously you get into your own lifestyle and career and things of that nature. So you just remember some of the players and obviously your coach.
I know you played a lot of sports growing up, but basketball, the notion, was it always clear like, oh, boy, if I could be a basketball lifer in this sport, that would be great.
Well, as you know, those days you played the sport of the season.
Right.
There was a delineation between seasons, you know, 4 months with this, and then you'd switch. But in the town I'm from, Kearney, soccer was the preeminent sport. And we used to say, if you didn't play soccer, you weren't considered an athlete in that town.
Which is pretty major back in those days.
Yeah, it was a city of a lot of immigrants.
Soccer was the first sport in Kearney because of immigrants?
Yeah, well, it was. And my brother ended up being a high school coach and won 10, 11, 12 state championships with kids in that town. And in the early 90s, the World Cup had three kids, Harks, Mayola, and Ramos, all from our town on the World Cup team. Right. So that'll sort of give you an indication of and then each club would have a team representing, you know, a youth group or whatever.
Right.
So anyway, it was just part of the whole regimen of getting into sports, basically, because really that was your life.
You are, of course, known for the phrases, but those who really know about how much preparation you put into every game. And so in terms of announcing a game. And so I'm curious, the notion of having the book with every game, as I've been told you have, is that something early on that people said to you, hey, you know, if you're going to do this, you got to do this?
Well, the story for me, well, twofold. It started actually with Bob Wolf, who I adored. And I had a broadcasting camp, which Bird Ion did later. And Bob, I was a senior, and Bob showed up. We were going to be the CBS game of the week in the NIT. And our coach said, I want you to have dinner with him. So when Bob left the next day, he said, you know, whenever you finish playing or whatever you're going to do, you ought to try and get into our business. That thing stuck with me through playing, coaching, and any rate, the point to get back to your question, when I started, I always said I wasn't a good player, so I became a good coach. I wasn't a good coach, so I got into broadcasting. And basically, when I got into broadcasting, I said, geez, I really like this. And I figured, you know, all these great players and coaches are going to be retiring, you know, the glitter of their name and the cachet and all that. I said, I'm just going to stick my head down, mind my own business, and do, you know, prep and be ready for every game and treat it like it is the game of the year, no mm-hmm. matter who it was. And that's how the book started, I guess. I mean, it's in fact, I'm just sitting here getting ready for a couple. I've got Wisconsin this weekend with Purdue, but I'm like doing stuff for a couple of weeks ahead. You know, Kentucky Gonzaga another week, that kind of stuff. So it becomes a habit, as you know, you've got pals in the business, and you know, you just, I like to be, when I get off the plane, be done and just go to the practices to sort of wrap things up a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's no replacement for preparation.
Right. Right.
In anything actually, but certainly in the broadcasting world.
Well, you don't like to see something, not necessarily you've never seen before, but not to recognize it. You may not even be able to vocalize it because the game is so quick, but you just feel, I don't think it's an obligation. It's just that you just want to be as prepared as you can be and give it as much as the two coaches and the two teams have done.
Now, the notion when you're first starting out in broadcasting, the notion that you can show your personality, is that something you feel comfortable with right from the get-go, or did you have to do it for a little while, and then maybe somebody says to you, "Hey, look, relax. You're good at this. You can do it. You can show more personality."
No, you know, I think I like to think I was the same. You know, I remember Bruce Beck, you know, from New York, and a dear friend too. Bruce did my first tape years ago. He was Suburban 6, I think, in Essex County, New Jersey, on the beginning of his illustrious career. And I like to think that it was just having a conversation with Bruce. And that's what I try and do with each and every partner. So I don't think I just said, oh, this is the way I'm going to go. I honestly think that the game is enjoyable, and you try not to make it less enjoyable for people. And also, Hubie Brown to me is probably the greatest in terms of X's and O's. And, you know, I think for me, it's a mix of the X's and O's and the fellas you're working with, or gals in many cases too, with sideline reporters. And I think it's just a mix of who you are, who you've palled around with, the phrases you might have used growing up that sort of pop into your head on occasion that sort of fit what just transpired.
You talk about growing up. When we were playing the game growing up, it was just as much fun to narrate it or to call it as, well, I think it was more fun to actually hit the shot as opposed to call the shot. But, you know, calling it as you were doing it was part of the fun. Can I imagine that some of this gift of gab comes from schoolyards that you're playing in growing up in Kearney?
Yeah, it is Kearney, but it's probably more Hudson County. As I mentioned, soccer was the biggest sport in Kearney, and our most famous athlete was Alex Webster, the football player.
Right.
He was our neighbor. He lived on Elm, and I lived on Devon. And as we got older and I got to know him better, we used to say we had adjoining estates. Well, that meant that the line for the clothing connected the pole in his yard kind of deal. There was an era in the 50s where basketball all of a sudden had a lot of interest. Older guys that you waited on the sideline. You've heard these stories all over New York where you waited. And as a young kid, late in the afternoon, you might get in with them because guys would get tired or they were going home or getting ready for the evening. And so that's how I started playing with older people. Then they would take me to these play-in or step-up games around Hudson County or Essex County. And, you know, you ended up never saying much and just listening. And I guess a lot of stuff you wouldn't say in your house, but a lot of things sort of, you know, stimulated the way you deliver things, or the way you put sentences together. And I guess it would be a form of woofing, as they do in the NBA now. Trash talking, I guess, but not at the level it is now. It was actually, you were pretty subdued in the old days.
How about that notion of gift of gab? Any of that come from watching and hearing your folks growing up in the house that you grew up in?
Well, it may. I had a brother and a sister, both passed away. My sister became a nun, and she was president of St. Elizabeth's College. My brother became a superintendent of schools. And at dinner, if there was an award, which they won because they were more inclined academically, or any of us achieved anything, it was mentioned. And that was enough of that. We, you know, both Irish immigrants, really a blessing that, you know, there was never talking about sports per se. It was more about you doing the right thing, making sure you did your schoolwork. And, you know, my mother used to say, well, that's enough about that. If somebody, you know, if something come up about some achievement that one of us made. So you never thought it was a big deal. It was pretty refreshing. And looking back, they were brilliant, you know, raising the three of us.
Talk a lot about the old country, or was it all pretty much full steam ahead in the new country?
No, pretty never, seldom. No, it was more, we would have relatives come and stay on a visit. And my mother and father went back in the late 30s with my sister, who was a baby, and she was the oldest. And they never went back again because they wanted to remember it the way it was. And the other point was they couldn't afford to go back, I'm sure.
Right.
Plus raising, you know, the three of us. But I remember my mother sending a letter every weekend and with a $5 bill to her mother. And I think there were 10 children in their family. And they basically were farmers. And she did that throughout our lifetime. You know, now $5 doesn't sound like a lot. But when you're living on a farm and, you know, in between harvesting and cows and sheep and stuff like that, it becomes a nice little bonus for the family. But it was never really about how they had it, or it never about it was tough for them. You know, Dad was a hard. We played the NIT game, which I had I contributed to us losing, getting back to Bob Wolf. I took a bad shot late. Anyhow, I came home with my backcourt mate, Tony Abbott, who's still living, thank God. And my father was in bed in the afternoon, late afternoon, and he was seriously sick. And we really didn't have a family doctor, but I knew through sports this Dr. Seawick, who, you know, we went to for everything, headaches, ankles, you know, no specialists for us in those days. So I called him to come, and my father had a totally collapsed lung, and a half of the other lung was collapsed. And Dr. Seawick said, Mr. Rafter, you have to go to the hospital. He said, no, I've got to go to work. His shift was, that was more important. And the doctor said, Mr. Rafter, if you go to work, you're going to die. And that's how they got him to go to the hospital. So that was sort of like a lesson without even having a dialogue. You know, like,
is there ever a conversation as you're growing up about basketball? Like, look, Mom, Dad, this is what I want to do. You know, I love this.
Never. They never brought anything up about success or achievements or pat you on the back, or, you know, you just knew they were in your corner. They were your parents. It was a blessing, to be honest with you. I mean, I probably had the greatest growing up, both family and sports, with the guys who coached me, people who helped me, and parenting. I mean, they were great influences, but they never intruded.
Now, I know about it because I went to school in Philly and saw many a game there. But a lot of people don't know about the beauty and the wonder of the Big Five, the five schools in Philadelphia, and you went to LaSalle. So for those who did not go there, did not experience a game at the Palestra, you've been in a lot of arenas around the country. How would you describe, in those years especially when you're playing, what a game at the Palestra was like?
Well, one of the reasons I went to the St. Joe's LaSalle game my senior year in high school, and I had never been exposed to anything like that. And I'm not so sure there was another Big Five game in a doubleheader. I forget how they did it then. And it may have been, but I think they would have that and then maybe an Ivy game, you know, if Penn wasn't in the Big Five game that particular night. And I just couldn't get over the atmosphere, raucous and involved, and, you know, just thoroughly into the game itself and knowledgeable and, you know, rooting for their teams. And maybe for one city, the best coaches. You had Jack McCleskey, Severance, and then later Kraft. And then you got Litwack, right? And Jack Ramsey. And we had Duty Moore, who made his name actually in Pittsburgh and was, you know, Sayugo Green, the Ricketts brothers, just an unbelievable, well-known coach. Well, he was the least known in the city of Philadelphia, our coach. But it was just a happening. We used to say it was like a date night. That Saturday night, if the game was on the weekend, that was like the biggest thing for fans. Like, that would be a big deal to take your, you know, girlfriend at that point. But at any rate, it was like a special evening. Even for, you know, for when I say even for players, but for the whole student body and the city, you know, it was such a rich tradition. High school wise, you know, thinking of Wilt and Gola and Arizin and those guys way before us. And it was handed down, you know, class to class to class. And it was a living, vibrant atmosphere.
I would think it's safe to say that most of the people who know your work from broadcasting for so many years and love that work don't know that you tried out for the New York Knicks and made it to the final cut.
Oh, I don't know. Well, I will say this. Red Holzman, and it's too long to explain, but Red Holzman became a very good friend of ours. And when I say ours, my mother used to write letters to Red. We had them and we can't find them. So they're somewhere in the homes, the respective homes. And she would say before the season, "Dear Mr. Holzman, I hope the Knickies have a great year. I'll be praying for you," that kind of thing. So going back to when I went to camp, I got cut at lunch. And I found out later, Red then was the scout, not the assistant coach. They didn't have one in those days, but virtually he was. And I guess he asked Eddie Donovan at lunch, "Where's Billy?" And Eddie Donovan said, "I cut him." So it was a pretty funny routine. But that was Gola and Gurren were the backcourt. If you're in, both of them are in the Hall of Fame. Yeah. So even though those days were only eight teams too. But it was a great experience. And Richie Gurren, God bless him, he denies this to this day. But I was leaving. I got my gear and I'm leaving. New York Military Academy up by West Point. That's where they practice then.
Right.
And I'm leaving, and Gurren and Gola are walking in for the afternoon session. They said, "Where are you going?" And I said, "I got cut." So Tommy, being a LaSalle guy and another influence in going there, said, "Geez, I'm sorry, Billy, blah, blah, blah." And Richie Gurren said, "Well, Billy, if you need tickets, call Tommy." So Gurren to this day denies it. And it became a great lesson. Like, okay, it's over. You know, you got to move into some other area. There was no ABA in those days. The only thing they had was the Eastern League, which, you know, it hadn't. And I went back. I was the director of recreation in Kearney besides going to the Knick camp. And if I did make the Knicks, I was going to be able to do both. And one of the guys who worked with us was a soccer referee. And he came back from a game. He said, you know, Fairleigh Dickinson and Madison, the AD is the soccer coach, basketball coach, lacrosse coach, and he doesn't want to coach basketball. And he said, I told him you got cut. I called him. That's how I started college coaching. A soccer referee getting me employed.
Whatever it takes.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. It's like they say in baseball, all line drives in the box score.
Yeah. That's right.
Doesn't matter how you get there. You know, there were signs of you would eventually become known for these sayings, but I don't imagine that there are too many times during a college basketball game that one coach sends a note to another coach, like, and I don't imagine it happened too many times to Luke Carnesecca, but when was that game and what was that experience?
Well, what had happened, we played Syracuse, the Heimer, I contributed a lot of wins to him. The Heimer beat us up pretty good on a Saturday night, and we had three kids who did whatever. So we decided we wouldn't play them on Monday. And so I used to say the game was over in warmups because we weren't very deep anyhow. And Louis' kids were good, as they always were. And they were up pretty good at halftime. And the second half starts, and now they put another 10 on the board. And it's over, basically. And I just had the manager bring a note down to Louis, who still thinks it's tie score. You know? And I said, Dear Luigi, I surrender, love, Bill. And then I put, P.S., would you like to work against a 2-3 zone? So he takes his glasses out and reads it. Then he finally looks up and goes, shakes his head. So we put a 2-3 zone up. We figured somebody had to get something good out of this. Now, having said that, imagine doing that now, you'd be fired, I'm sure. Yeah. But
and it would be all over. It would be all over Twitter in about 12 seconds. Yeah.
What was interesting, though, we were decent, and it was the beginning of the Big East, and like, as you know, it became a monster.
Yeah.
And that was like 80, 79, 80, I guess, when that happened. But that class of 81 was the one with Ewing and, of course, Mullen up there and Pinckney, and then you name them all, you know, down the line. Just I don't think there's ever been a league like it.
So was the decision to leave Seton Hall and leave coaching a difficult one, or was it pretty clear?
We had started the third year of the Big East that fall, and we were going to open in the Meadowlands, brand new Meadowlands at that time. And we had the same budget as Richie Regan had, he was my AD, but he was the coach. In fact, he had played in Rochester with Red Holzman. That's somewhat of a connection, but we had the same budget and the same, you know, support group, whether it was food or training. We really didn't meet the needs necessary like a Syracuse. But I wasn't thinking about that at all. And Dave Gavitt, we had started a couple of, like October 28th of 81, he called and said, look, I had said to him during the year, you know, someday I might like to do that. But at that point when I said it, I thought I was going to become John Wooden. It certainly didn't transpire. And he said, look, if you want to announce, you've got 2 days, because I just don't want to deal with everybody applying and have to interview. So in 2 days, I decided. And I left for 9 games, $800 a game with 4 children, $7,200, and just rolled the dice. And I've always said this to our kids, don't do anything for money. I mean, if you really like something, it'll work out somehow. And that's basically how I went about it. And then I got 25 ESPN games for $500 a game. I got 3 or 4 NBC games for maybe $1,050. I don't even remember the number. And I started with a bank, which was like the greatest thing in the world. For some 20 years, the greatest people in business, industry, and like we had the Giants, the Jets, the Meadowlands, we had the casinos, we were like salesmen. I couldn't balance my checkbook, but I was then a banker. But they would let me go and do all these games. So that was the first year. The second year, CBS, I signed with them. And then I signed with the Nets the same time and ESPN. And then that went all the way until, 2001, three or four with the Nets. And then 13, when Fox started with the new Big East, I went with them. So it's been, just when you say enjoyable, I have no idea where the time went, but I know I had a good time.
Are there any lessons from those early years, either growing up in your folks' home, growing up in Kearney, going to LaSalle, or even, you're the, director of recreation in town? Any lessons from those years? I mean, we see you on a national level now and have for a long time. Any of those early lessons that pertain to the work you do today?
Well, I think you are, in substance, what your house provides or initiates or creates for you. And I think everything, the way I've looked at everything is pretty much the way my folks looked at life, that, you do the best you can and be prepared. And this was never a dialogue. This is all just gleaned from being around them. And then being around some great people, whether it's Bill Farabee with the bank or my high school coach or my college coach or people along the way. I think you learn a lot by keeping quiet and observing. And, I think I've always been around really good people who get it. And hopefully those lessons, from the observation, to the reality and commitment of moving in, doing the right things, basically, taking care of your obligations.
Of the, I would imagine, hundreds of times you've heard it, can you tell me perhaps the most unusual place that someone has approached you and said, "Send it in, Jerome"?
Some arenas in the men's room, believe it or not. The old days when they had the sky caps at the airport, and you'd pull up and we'd get to know them, whether it was Newark Airport or others, and you'd hear, well, the other one, I'm just walking, I had no idea I was saying man to man without a break, like man to man. And this sky cap said, man to man. And I'm saying, I have no idea what he was saying. And so that was, and the other one that Ian Eagle, who's got a great memory, we were doing a Nets, he claims Orlando, I thought Miami, and the Nets weren't doing very well, and Kevin Edwards made a corner jumper for a win, and it gave the Nets maybe their 20th win and 45 losses, kind of a deal, one of those. And I blurted out, "Onions." I had never said it before, never thought about it before. And like, I've heard that quite a bit. And the "send it in, Jerome" is like, it's amazing. Younger people say it. Someone, they're like, their father or their grandfather must have told them about it. But those were the Big East days too, where Pitt was pretty darn good.
Right.
And Sean Miller always says, "I made your career," because he made the pass that led to the goal for Jerome Lane.
Yeah. Well, it's brought a lot of people joy through a lot of years, Bill.
Oh, that's nice. But it's a pleasure to say hello to you and meet you hopefully one of these days over a cocktail or lemonade. Let's keep it at a high level,
That sounds great. Bill Raftery. You'll be hearing and seeing a lot of him over the next month during the NCAA basketball tournament, bringing the excitement and joy of the game to millions of us. Before the Cheering Started is a production of June 14th Productions and Gemini 13 Productions. This episode was created and written by me. Guitar playing, that's me as well. No extra charge. I'm Bud Mishkin, and this is Before the Cheering Started. Thanks for joining us on the journey.